things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
Hi!
Hi! How are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
I'm absolutely exhausted. Is that a new shelf?
Yeah, do you
I
like
love
it?
That. That is so cute.
And my little bottles.
I love them. We got a little witch shit happening up there. Ooh, super cool. Post a picture of that on Instagram.
I have eucalyptus leaves, white rose petals, and then I have red rose petals in there.
I see you drying some white rose petals.
Yeah,
there.
Drying some more white. But yeah. So.
Cute.
I love my little shelfie guy. This room is basically brought to you by IKEA.
Yeah.
So I got all of that at IKEA.
I love that.
Thanks.
It's great. You're doing a great job. It's beautiful in here.
Thanks. Yeah. So I was like, I'm excited. And I have two more little shelves that are going to go under it that can hold those bottles so they don't jiggle around.
Aww.
So I think I'm going to put my essential oils over there and then I'm going to put more herbs up.
Amazing. Job well done.
Thanks.
We love a witchy interior decorator.
That's all I want.
You have to
functionality with a decor.
Is that not what we all want? I just reorganized our pantry in Lazy Susan.
Oh.
They are not aesthetically pleasing, but by God, is it functional.
I like it.
Thank you. I can shut the door. I know.
Wow.
This is so really so cool.
So excellent.
I love it.
Oh man, so what's new in your life? Any new updates?
Not really. I'm just really tired. I'm not sleeping well. So you texted me.
Yeah.
What 2 days ago or whatever day it was. Because Taylor was dreaming about me all night. And
literally all night.
So I have a theory, and this could be total bullshit, but you know, like you have some nights where you fall asleep in a dream and then you wake up, and then you have nights where you fall asleep and it's like you don't remember your dreams, but when you wake up, you know that you were dreaming.
Yeah.
And then there are nights where you fall asleep and it's like you enter a black hole,
uh-huh.
And then you, it's like going under for anesthesia.
Yeah.
And then you just wake up and it's like you're whatever. I think that when you have nights like that, it's because other people are dreaming of you and like borrowing
your essence.
Yeah, like your spirit.
Uh-huh.
Which, and if that is the case, somebody, including you.
Sorry.
It's okay, but it's been like 6 nights in a row.
Oh my gosh.
Like, I am really plaguing.
I would love for you to have your own dreams.
That I would also love for me. And I'm normally like a very vivid dreamer.
Me too.
So it's bizarre.
That is weird.
And then I wake up like I have had no sleep.
Huh. Like, the dreams that I had about Jenny the other night were so vivid, and it felt very much like there were 3 separate dreams.
Yeah.
But all 3 dreams had Jenny in them. And we were doing, like, I mean, I would consider it normal shit for us, but we weren't doing anything super, super crazy.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it was just wild. I woke up and texted her at like 7:30, and I was like, girl, I have so much to tell you. We were so busy last night.
I know, you know what? I felt like it.
Yeah.
Too. But I really, that's my theory. I don't know if anybody agrees, but.
That's a good theory. I also haven't been sleeping super well, so I wonder if it's just kind of.
Mercury in the microwave?
Yeah, it's doing something.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah, I haven't had very, like, I've just woken up a lot.
Yeah. Like stuff. Toss and turn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Josephine. Woke us up in the middle of the night the other night. I heard a thunk.
Okay.
And my bed is not, I don't have my bed on like a normal
frame.
There are drawers under my bed.
Oh, I love beds like that.
Yeah, so you can't just, I don't store anything under my bed. It's just drawers. But my headboard has a small square hole behind it.
Okay.
And we have those blocked off because we don't want the cats under there.
Uh-huh.
Somehow Josephine managed to, like, get back there.
A little weasel.
But we couldn't figure out where she was, but she scared the shit out of me. She thumped something behind under the bed.
Yeah.
I scared Izzy, who was sleeping on me, so then he, like, clawed me. And then I kept hearing this, like, tap, 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 tap. And then this, meow.
Oh, God.
The tiniest meow. And finally, I like sat up in bed and I was like, what the fuck? And I got up and I started looking around and Ryan's like, what are you doing? And I was like, I think Joe is stuck somewhere. And she gets herself stuck in drawers quite often.
I believe that. That sounds very much up her alley.
Right. So we have drawers that have a sheer, not quite opaque glass on the front.
Yeah.
And I have seen her like pause and face to the glass like, let me out.
Oh, how did you get in there?
I don't know. But she's gotten stuck in the drawers, under the bed, all that kind of stuff. So I was thinking she's in a drawer.
Yeah.
Nope, not in a drawer. We checked out in the garage because the garage is right next to our bedroom. She's not in the garage. And it took us like a full 10 minutes to figure out that she was behind the headboard. And
Josephine!
Oh my gosh. To wake up and have that kind of like adrenaline going at 1:30 in the morning, I was like, we're never going back to sleep.
No.
And
you panic. You're like, is she hurt? Yeah.
I really think that we laid awake for another 2 hours.
Oh, God.
Being like that little asshole.
Such a shit for no reason. This is a happy one, though.
He's a sweet happy boy.
I take picture posts on Instagram.
He says, I famous cat now.
I have fans.
Oh, what a doofus. He says, I pose for you.
I pose. Do you like how I look? Aww.
Sweet noogle nugget.
He is a noogle nugget. I wish that there was a cult just dedicated to Happy being cute.
Oh, I think there might be.
Do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I know that I seem to have quite the cult in my house that's obsessed with Happy Cat.
You and Ryan?
Me and Ryan. That's all.
That's all that matters.
Yeah. So, speaking of cults, do you want to go first today?
Yeah,
we decided before we started recording.
Hi,
who's going first?
Don't say people never change.
We're working on it.
We have growth. Yes, I'm so stoked.
I can't wait
to talk about this. It really is making me feel things. Okay.
Okay.
I will say, when, like, I was researching this and writing this, I was not feeling super candid.
Okay.
So I'm going to be very honest about how I feel about this cult. So I'm sorry.
You always are.
I know. And I'm sorry. And I know, like, a good journalist, like, your little journalist heart is like, be impartial and, like, report on the facts. But I'm like, no, my feelings.
Sure, I have
to impart them. Okay. So, the Brotherhood of the Broken Arrow. Have you ever heard?
It sounds so fictional.
I know. It sounds...
But I don't think that I've heard of the real thing.
The entire thing sounds made up.
Oh, God. I can't wait.
And it's not the Boy Scouts. I ran into that a lot.
Really?
Because they have, like, a ritual called the Brotherhood of, like, the Golden Arrow.
Ooh.
Or something. That would be a good cult episode.
Boy Scouts?
Yes. Or true crime, maybe. Anyway, so hold on to your butt. This is a weird one.
All right.
I kindly present for your consideration a French hedonistic satanic sex cult founded by a woman who was revered and adored by a whole gaggle of men she charmed into following her.
She started a cult called the Brotherhood?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Cool. Yeah, a whole gaggle. Is it a gaggle? Gaggle of men?
Yeah.
What's a group of men called?
A scare.
Threatening? Okay. I will say, just to be totally blatantly honest, I would 1000% be in this cult.
Okay.
Without hesitation.
All right.
So I love the whys of cult fellowship and like why they form. And this one has a very clear path to like cultural, political, social movements of the time. We are in the mid 1800s in Europe, and it was transformative for art and literature.
Okay.
And we were moving from the neoclassical art era into like modern day romanticism of like Chopin, Tchaikovsky, Debussy, Rembrandt, Delacroix, Jane Austen, the Bronte sisters.
Okay.
All that good stuff. Dickens and like John Keats. Artists and composers and writers were exploring a much lighter theme in their art than they were in neoclassical times. And romantic art of all forms is like sunshine and daisies and like how wonderful to be alive and in love. The Napoleonic Wars were just over. France just had its third and finally successful revolution, third time's a charm. And all things kind of seemed to be on the up and up. Mm-hmm. Everybody was just pleased as punch. So the art and the culture reflected that. Romanticism was like, you know, the like love and light girls uh-huh. that like you see on Instagram. Yeah. That was the romantic era.
Great.
So there was a group of avant-garde artists who were not super feeling it. They thought it was unrealistic of the time that there was like an underbelly that wasn't being represented. And this was all, quote, banal progress. The wars had only been over literally like a month and things were still pretty whack. So there was a new movement that started called the Decadents. Okay.
I like that.
Yeah, it's a cool name.
All right.
Decadence. So from Wikipedia, the first major development in French decadence appeared when writers Théophile Gautier and Charles Baudelaire used the word proudly to represent a rejection of what they considered banal progress. Baudelaire referred to himself as decadent in his 1857 edition of Le Fleur du Mal, which I think is like the bad flowers or like the rotten flowers or something.
Okay.
And exalted the Roman decline as a model for modern poets to express their passion. And then he used the term to include, like, different kinds of pursuits. So I promise that this is important. Happy, we have to figure it out.
He is being a squirmy.
He is. I promise this is important because it planted a seed of, like, indulgence and pursuit of pleasure just for the sake of pleasure. And further exploration of, like, the occult and darker themes was, like, the rise of that, which was a seed.
Interesting.
Yes. Enter Maria D. Naglowska. She specifically entered in 1883 in St. Petersburg, Russia. She was a daughter of the governor of Kazan, but was orphaned at 12. Her extended family sent her away to Smolina Institute, because what else are you supposed to do with girls? And she fell in love with Moise Hopenko. I'm so sorry, I butchered that name. He was just like a regular middle-class Jewish guy, and her family disowned her because he was so below her status, because she was like incredibly wealthy and powerful. And so the two in love ran away to Berlin and then to Geneva, Switzerland, where they were married and she had three children. But he decided he wasn't cut out for family life and moved to Palestine.
Oh.
Yeah. Just out. You know what? On second thought.
Don't want that.
I think I'm out, though.
Goodbye.
Bye. Maria, still abandoned by her family and without access to her inherited wealth, was forced to make her own way in the world and provide. And she did so by becoming a school teacher and a journalist, but it was the early 1800s, and she was a woman with radical ideas who refused to speak in whispers, and she was ultimately imprisoned and then exiled from Switzerland for her liberal views.
Refused to speak in whispers. I want that on a t-shirt.
Refused to speak. I love that. I wrote that.
I love that.
Thanks.
I want it on a t-shirt.
Well, we can do that.
We can.
Listen, DM us if you want that on a t-shirt. I refuse to speak in whispers.
Taylor's going to be the only one that wants that.
I'll want it. Oh, but wait, I lost my place.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
I'm sorry.
So she was exiled from a whole ass country. We don't have exact dates, but around the 1920-ish time frame, she hustled her way down to Rome. What a time to be alive for Maria, because in Rome, she meets the acquaintance of Giulio Cesare Andrea Evola. He went by Julius, and this man.
Oh, bud.
He was an esoteric guy. He was described as a fascist intellectual, a radical traditionalist, anti-egalitarian, anti-liberal, anti-democratic, and anti-popular poet, philosopher, and painter, credited with as the father of Europe's neo-fascist movement. Huh. He's yucky. His worldview was, like, bold and had a very specific anti-Semitic flavor, but he also hated Christians.
Great.
Right. He was hugely popular in French circles because of his supernatural, metaphysical, and magical beliefs, including ghosts, telepathy, and alchemy. He also had really strong ideas about male-dominated society, as if that is not what was already happening.
Right.
She hung around him in this circle for a while before moving to Paris in 1929. Now, Maria, an orphan, abandoned by her parents, her family, her husband, and her country, listening to a piece of shit, for lack of better words, go on and on about running the world and ghosts and seances. This next section is going to make a lot of sense. She started earning her way in Paris by hosting occult seminars.
Oh.
She wasn't pulling in like droves and droves of people, and her audience was pretty small, but she started to make a name for herself and soon caught the eye of some of the like avant-garde surreal artists of the time who were hanging on to the tail end of the decadent movement. I told you it would be important.
Mm-hmm.
Including William Seabrook, who was cannibal curious.
What?
He dabbled. Self-described. Dabbled in cannibalism. I know.
Interesting.
Yes.
Just a little side cannibal for you.
Cannibal curious. He's just like, I could go either way. Man Ray and Andre Breton and a few others, and the whole motley crew became entangled after many seminars, intimate gatherings, and feeding off of each other. And
not literally.
Okay.
Just want to clarify.
Just like snacks.
Great.
People charcuterie.
Yum.
People charcuterie for artists. So that's how the Brotherhood of the Broken Arrow was born. So it was Maria and these like handful of men.
Random dudes.
Yeah, random dudes. She also has quite a wealth of contributions to satanic literature, starting by her French translations of works written by Paschal Beverly Randolph, who was an American mysticist of the time. She also wrote Advanced Sex Magic, Initiatic Eroticism, The Light of Sex, Magia Sexualis, and The Sacred Rite of Magical Love.
I want all of those.
So you can find them.
Great.
You can find them and buy them. She also published a spooky newspaper called La Flesh, which is...
Fun!
Which is The Arrow is the name. And her and a bunch of other French occultists of the time contributed to, including good old Julio. He would write in it as well. And now I'm not expecting you to go out and read her collection of works, even though you should. But if you do, you would find that initiatic eroticism, she discusses a mysterious monk who she had encountered in her travels.
Okay.
He was a mystic and imparted divine knowledge unto her. He drew a triangle on a board and explained the true definition of the Holy Trinity. The Father, who represented reason and judgment in Judaism. The Son, who represented Christianity in the heart and soul and love. And the Holy Ghost, that was a feminine entity and had, like, strong sexual connotations.
Okay.
This experience laid the foundation of her belief that the light and dark of life, death, and humanity was in constant flux, and that she and her followers could pursue reconciliation and ensure balance. She believed that the Roman Catholic Church purposefully pitted nature and divinity against each other, and it was a dangerous dogma used to separate people from God, because in the Catholic Church, followers can only speak to God through a priest,
mm-hmm.
and Maria didn't think that this was true, and she called this theory the third term of the Trinity.
Okay.
So, cool. Like I said earlier, she had some, like, pretty wackadoodle ideas. Even for like a more modern time. Once she was built to speak at Club de Faubourg and delivered a seminar titled Magic and Sexuality. What is coitus and what is the magic serpent? It was so erotic in nature that the club was charged with an outcry to public decency.
Oops.
They were found guilty. Oh. But like a year later, they appealed it. And so they dropped it off the record.
Oh.
Her new initiates were required to read The Light of Sex before being able to join and participate in the group and their activities. She described herself as a woman of Satan.
Uh-huh.
And she used satanic symbols in all of her practice. And she proselytized to her flock about Satan, not as an external maliciousness hell-bent on devastation and pain, but instead as an internal force of intrinsic human nature. That it's like a part. Of Satan is a part of you.
Okay.
She believed that the roles of high priestess and mother were the true roles that were required to, like, fully satisfy the purpose of womanhood. And mm-hmm. that there was, like, a divinity within those two roles. In saying so, uh-huh. that, men aren't the only ones who were having all the fun here.
Okay.
She took on female acolytes and named them Sophialis.
Okay.
It's cool, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it cool? She deemed them the new matriarchal power, and women within the brotherhood were considered high priestesses. Incapable of passing on extreme, volatile, and even dangerous energy through sexual acts with men through ritual. And only those who were spiritually awakened were able to receive the power.
Damn.
Can you see why I would abandon my life?
Absolutely. 100%.
Okay, so I'm about to go into detail about some of their rituals. And this was, like, already bordering, like, PG-13R. But okay. This is strictly 18, not safe for work. Google incognito mode.
Okay. All right. I can't wait. Hope you got your headphones on.
Get your headphones on. No kids. Roll your windows up.
Let's go.
So one of the first-hand accounts we have describes a ceremony that includes a wholly, entirely naked Maria.
Okay.
Leisurely reclining on top of their ceremonial altar. While her male companions placed a chalice, the exact wording said upon her cucaracha. My brain cannot visualize or understand what upon means in this context. Like, I can't imagine that they're, like a coaster? Like, are you the coaster for the... It's a big cup. It's like a golden goblet. And they place it upon her little... a kitty cat coaster, if you will.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
And then all of the men would gather around as she had the goblet and would loudly proclaim, "I will strive by any means to illuminate myself with the aid of a woman who knows how to love me with virgin love. I will research with companions the initiatory erotic act while transforming the head into light, which arouses Lucifer from the satanic shades of masculinity."
This woman.
Oh my.
Out here doing the most.
Power move. Seriously.
Okay. I mean, I'm here for it.
To lay naked on a table and have men gather around you and chant. I didn't know it was a dream.
The power trip that I would be on.
Oh my God.
It would be.
I wouldn't know how to act.
I would be dangerous.
Same. Yeah, me as...
The ego.
But
too
me, like,
much.
I would only wear gauzy nightgowns.
Absolutely. Sheer black gauzy nightgowns.
Yes.
That's all I would wear.
My nipples would be out all the time. They just would.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. They would.
This woman is like a walking succubus.
Yes. Yes. She's very Lilith energy.
Yes.
So... Any autoerotic asphyxiation fans out there? Because
raise your hand.
Raise your hand. Let us see. Because she can be like traced back to the roots.
Oh wow.
Of that. More specifically, her rite, trial by hanging. It describes in more detail. It is described in more detail in the book Demons of the Flesh, which includes other fun facts about Maria, but gives us a good idea of how this went down. So, a male companion would stand naked and be sexually stimulated by the high priestesses who were gathered in the ritual, but not to completion.
Okay.
And at the height of his arousal, he would be voluntarily and partially hanged until he lost consciousness. While blacked out, but still
alive.
Alive. Erect is what
I'm... Okay, right.
It's important for the ritual. So while his body hung, his soul would also hang in limbo, in quote, the crux of the balance between light and dark. And Maria called this state as above all delights. And soon the ligature around his neck would be loosened. And when his spirit returned to his body or he regained consciousness, he would experience, as described in The Light of Sex, the explosive penetration of the resplendent woman at the sublime moment of holy coitus. Which,
damn,
is like a mind, body, and soul orgasm.
I'm sure they had the best times of their lives.
Oh my gosh, the best! They're having a blast!
And I just, in my head, this is all happening in like a dimly lit cave.
That, yes, I have photos of her on the altar. Like, I have photos of this.
Oh,
they're
my gosh.
On the Instagram.
Okay.
So this like collection of like artists are really choking each other out, having orgies. Satan worship, having sex here, there, and everywhere.
Oh no.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
So, and I know this is like an abrupt ending, but in 1935, Maria had a prophecy of her own death and disbanded the group to go move in with her daughter in Zurich. And then she passed away a few months later, in April of 1936 at the age of 52.
Oh, what?
Yeah. I will say her contributions to whatever this was,
yeah,
was not in vain. And that all of these artists who are in her group went on to be like famous, surreal artists. And in 1959 was named as a person of important influence at the International Surrealism Exhibition in Paris.
Wow.
So she, it's a power move. An absolute, like, I'm willing to reboot the movement.
Are you going to sacrifice yourself for it?
Yeah, I will.
You'll lay down on the altar for this.
I'll buy some nightgowns.
Great, let's go.
My sources were The Brotherhood of the Golden Arrow by Cynthia Verdey, published on demiworld.net, November 2019. The Setian Illuminati, 2013. Maria Dean Naglowska and the Doctrine of the Third Term of the Trinity by Troy Southgate, 2018. And Xena Nicholas Schreck, Demons of the Flesh, The Complete Guide to Left-Hand Path Sex Magic, which if you want like a reading recommendation, there
you go.
There you go. There you go.
Sounds like something on Kindle Unlimited.
I cannot imagine like a more potent energy to have in your life.
No. That would be
pinnacle, peak. Me pre-20, like pre-Ian in my 20s. Would have just gobbled that up.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Yep.
Could have lost me to
that.
Can
attest.
Yes. Very easily.
to that struggle.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Good job. That was really cool.
Thank you. I like
her. It's not normal that we get a cult that's like...
Cool.
Not absolutely god-awful.
They're, no crime. They committed no crime. They were all adults consenting.
Consenting to this activity.
Yeah.
We love consensual activities in this podcast.
There's nothing I love more than consent.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so my cult also has a very powerful woman at the helm.
Yeah!
You're gonna hate her.
Oh no.
You're gonna hate her so bad.
Oh man, I was in a really good girl support girls mood today.
I really am sorry to rip that away from you.
Okay.
Because this is uncomfy.
Okay.
A little bit. So this was actually a story suggestion from a listener who actually has a family member wrapped up in this craziness.
What?
Yeah. So she said that she's got, I believe it's a, I don't want to out it too much.
Okay.
She's got family that is actively in this cult.
Are they trying to get out or are they in it?
No, they're in it.
Oh.
In it and happy about it. Yeah.
Is it an MLM?
No, not really.
Okay.
Okay. Gwen Shamblin Lara was born February 18th, 1955 in Memphis, Texas. And we don't know whole Memphis, Texas. Memphis, Tennessee.
Okay.
I need some Adderall today, apparently. We don't have a whole lot of info on her childhood, but we do know that she is very well educated, which in this case makes her incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
Gwen attended the University of Tennessee and got her undergrad in dietetics. Yeah. And her master's in food and nutrition from Memphis State University. She was a registered dietitian, consultant, and faculty member at Memphis State University for many years. She also worked in the Tennessee Department of Health And trust me, you don't want this woman anywhere near your health.
Ooh, okay.
We do know that she married a man named David Shamblin in 1978. I'm going to give a little bit of a disclaimer now. For true crime, I hesitate to give like disclaimers or trigger warnings because it's a crime podcast.
Yeah.
This is a little different that I think does deserve a little bit of a little warning label.
Yeah.
This topic we are going to cover today covers information on eating disorders and a negative relationship with food. If this topic could be harmful to your mental health, I encourage you to skip the rest of this episode. I will do my best to be aware of the language used, but it's important to understand how damaging Gwen, Chamblin, and Lara's rhetoric is.
I mean, but I can't leave, though.
You have to stay.
But it's damaging to my mental health and my eating disorder, though. Taylor.
I believe in you.
Okay. You're just going to have to feed me a snack after.
I got you.
Okay.
Okay. In 1986, Gwen created a diet program called the Way Down Program. This was during the heroin chic era, which was popularized by pale skin, dark circles, emaciated features, androgyny, and very flat hair.
Which roots from a tuberculosis outbreak.
Yes. People desperately wanted to look like stick-thin models and actresses, even if that appearance was completely unachievable. And Jenny and I just had this conversation in my kitchen. I am going to a 90s party tonight. For general health, like, don't compare yourself to Nicole Kidman. It will end badly. which is what I tried to do, and I had to go in a different direction.
For the safety of your own well-being.
Absolutely. In 1993, Gwen claimed that her course was being taught all over the place, specifically in churches.
Oh no.
You're gonna hate her.
Don't tie in eating disorder trauma with religious trauma.
All wrapped in one.
No!
All wrapped together.
What a shitty sandwich.
She's horrible. God. She estimated that about 30,000 churches and homes were pushing her program.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. What'd she do? Was it good? I'm assuming not. It's a cult episode.
I'll tell. It's so... I wanted to give the warning on just, like, the negative relationship with food, because I know that is, especially people who are maybe closer to the church, like, they might see some legitimacy in this.
Yeah.
Because it's so highly, like, twisted into religion, I think that, like, people like you and I are not gonna take it too seriously because it's so entwined with religion.
Oh, God.
So she wrote a book on her program and started selling that by 1997. I promise you, someone's mom has this book in a cabinet somewhere, as more than 1 million copies were sold. The book is what launched Gwen into the stratosphere of popularity in the 90s. Soon she would amass an empire, which would eventually include a crusade to end a menagerie of daily activities, such as smoking, gossip, excessive TV watching, drug, porn addiction, and homosexuality.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
She got on the internet train fairly quickly and started her own webcast with this message. There is hope. There is an answer. You can lose weight permanently, Shamblin stated in her video. You have got to change, and you can change. The way to change is down this narrow path and this truth.
Ew.
Now, Gwen isn't the first person to intertwine the ideas of health and religion. The practices vary from program to program, but overall, basically, they're all the same. The idea is that if you serve the Lord, you'll be able to let go of the need to control your life. As Dana Hall describes it in a 1997 Washington Post article, indulgence is sin. That craving for chocolate might really be spiritual hunger, an emptiness that has nothing to do with food and everything to do with how close you are to God.
I'm appalled. What?
Gwen's program promotes the idea that you can eat whatever you want as long as you are eating to serve God.
What?
And not indulge in sin and gluttony.
What?
She would tell people that this isn't a one-size-fits-all program. One person could be eating cake and not sinning, while another person could be eating cake and sinning.
How? Make it make sense.
She said if you're... stomach isn't growling. You're not really hungry. But if you eat cake, even though your stomach's not growling, you're sinning. But if you're eating cake when your stomach growls and you only have one bite of cake, then you're not.
That doesn't track for me.
No. When Gwen was interviewed about her weigh down program, she would go to great lengths to try to convince the audience that this was the way of life, was completely achievable. She would snack on Snicker bars and drink pop during interviews to establish this idea. Like all great diet marketing, she says that this isn't a diet, it's a lifestyle change. Dieting makes people obsessive about food, she said. The food rules. I teach people to transfer their love of food to a love of God. Once you stop obsessing on the food, you'll be able to stop right in the middle of that candy bar. Why would you want to?
Just eat the candy bar, for fuck's sake.
I did text my sister-in-law, who is a dietitian.
Yeah.
And I was like, have you ever heard of this girl? And she said no. And I was like, you're gonna hate her. And I sent her like just a link of an article I read. And she sent me back and she's like, I'm furious. I was like, I know.
Oh my God, it's awful.
It's really horrible. At its core, the Weigh Down program says that you should be able to eat when your stomach is growling, and if you're craving, if you get a craving, you're not actually hungry, you should just pray about it.
Soup? No.
No.
Jesus.
Yes. In addition, when you do eat a meal, you should eat no more than 8 bites. 8. Number one, if I waited until my stomach was growling to eat every single bite, I cannot guarantee how many people in my life would still be living. Number two, I bet you money dollars that I could still eat an 8-ounce filet mignon in 8 bites.
Guarantee.
Bet.
Don't underestimate how good I can chew.
Don't estimate me in a steak.
I will get it down.
I will. So Gwen was interviewed by CNN, Fox News, Good Morning America, you name it.
Oh my God.
Yeah, she was really popular.
She got a lot of traction. Yes. Jeez.
She was the blue-eyed, blonde-haired savior to all of those who wanted to forge a new path for themselves. She was beautiful, and they wanted to be that, too. Most everyone who knew Gwen spoke of her charisma. People idolized her and desperately wanted to be in her inner circle. Many women read her books, and when she started putting out tapes on the Weigh Down program, they ate those up, too. Not literally.
They gobbled them up.
In the late 90s, she started going on book tours and doing motivational speeches. During all this, her husband David was pretty much kept out of the spotlight. There are speculations on why, but I think it's because he was heavy set and she didn't want him to ruin her image.
Was he?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, well, yep. Have you told him to pray about it?
Right, but he did not come to anything.
Okay. So. We love a supportive man.
Right. She sold out huge rooms with hundreds of people who were heavily invested in her rhetoric. She would bring people on stage with their old clothes to show the weight loss, and these women would say, I've lost 70 pounds by the grace of God. I've lost 50 pounds, but blessed be his name.
I want you to know that the grace of God is not making you lose weight. It is caloric restriction.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Just,
okay.
You're starving yourself.
Yes.
That's what's happening.
Been there.
Yeah.
It's not a great method.
It doesn't work long term.
No. Fuck no.
No. It doesn't. So just continually intertwining the idea that of weight loss and God and the idea that only God's chosen people are able to lose weight.
Sorry, you're having a hard time losing weight because God wants you to be large.
Yep. Reverend Rafael Martinez, a cult interventionalist, says in the HBO Max documentary, she began to believe that the Weigh Down workshop was the answer to all the world's evils. She had the truth. Christian perfectionism could only be achieved by following her message.
Oh my God.
From this realization came the idea that she needed to found a new church. A new restoration of Christianity that followed her message of God.
What is it? Skinny girls only?
It should be, but no. In 1999, she incorporated officially and created the Remnant Fellowship Church. One of the biggest deviations she took from the mainstream Christianity was that she removed the idea of the Holy Trinity.
Oh, that's a big move in Christianity.
Oh, yeah.
What'd she replace it with?
She believed that there was only God, that Jesus and the Holy Spirit were not.
It was just God.
It was just God.
Okay.
Go
off.
Yeah, this royally pissed off all the other churches around her, as they regarded the deviation and removal of the Holy Trinity as nothing short of heresy.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Before now, she was in really good standing with many of the churches, and most of them were teaching her program, like at Bible study and all kinds of stuff. And now they were calling and screaming and yelling about the Holy Trinity. They sent back her books in the hundreds. Books and tapes were tossed in the trash, donated, or packed away to never be seen again. They were like,
bad move, sister.
Bitch, no. In 2000, there was a conference called the Desert Oasis Way Down Workshop Convention in Nashville. This is where she announced her church to the to her followers. One of the women who was present says that half the people in the attendance accepted the message, while the other half promptly left.
Ooh.
Because she didn't have the Trinity.
Yeah.
Then she got herself into legal trouble by demanding that people that worked for her at the Way Down Workshop convert to her church.
Nope. Can't do that.
Can't do that. A group of about five women banded together to get a lawyer, and they sued Gwen for religious discrimination. During the deposition of this case, Gwen compares her Way Down program to Nazi concentration camps. The lawyer was stunned when she said this. There was just silence. And you can, part of this tape is on the HBO documentary.
What?
Yeah, and he's like, are you really, really comparing the two things? And she gets super defensive, and she was like, yeah, I've been comparing this for 15 years. And he was like, I would really reconsider.
I would encourage you.
Yeah.
To not think that way.
So, unfortunately, the dark just keeps getting darker when we find out the teachings of how to raise children in the Remnant Fellowship Church. Of course, children should always be obedient to their parents, but we don't know how strict those teachings were until 2003 when the Remnant Fellowship was wrapped up in another court case, this time for the death of an eight-year-old boy named Joseph Smith. According to NBC News, prosecutors said the Smiths, his parents, physically abused Joseph and locked him inside a wooden chest and put him in a closet. An autopsy determined that Joseph died from multiple blows to the head. The Smiths were both convicted of murder, involuntary manslaughter, cruelty, aggravated assault, reckless conduct, and false imprisonment. On what would have been Joseph's 11th birthday, they were both sentenced to life plus 30 years in prison. Police also brought up the fact that only 11 weeks before Joseph was killed, the Smiths lost another baby.
Whoa.
Their baby, Malik, died when he was a few months old, and the death was ruled SIDS.
Mm.
But most of the police were like, this is weird.
Yeah.
And then for the 8-year-old to die, they were like,
Something's
weird here.
Yeah.
In the course of the investigation, Cobb County authorities searched the Remnant Fellowship grounds as they believe the church encouraged corporal punishment. Unfortunately, they were unable to link Joseph's death to the teaching of the church, although many accounts say that the teachings of the church said to hit your children in such ways that they wouldn't leave marks. One babysitter said that one day while babysitting at the church, Joseph was in a corner crying, and she asked his dad what she could do to help him calm down, and his dad replied, hit him hard. Like, in front of all the other church people, and nobody said it.
Oh my god.
Yeah. Gwen told the children of the church that if they didn't obey their mom and dad that on the first ask, or if they were slow to obey, they would live a short life here on earth and be sent to hell because only obedient children get to go to heaven.
Oh my god.
Horrible.
That's some real religious drama right there.
Yeah, there's video of her teaching a Sunday school class with all these little tiny angel babies sitting around. And telling them that if they don't obey their mom and dad on their first ask, that they will go to hell. Yeah.
I am shocked.
It's real bad.
Disgusting.
Gwen,
poor kids.
Gwen had two children of her own with David, Michael and Elizabeth. Although they were appointed leaders within the church, Michael and Elizabeth were also the second in command, and everyone knew it.
Mm.
Michael was married to a woman named Erin, and Elizabeth was married to a man named Brandon. Sadly, Elizabeth and Brandon lost a son when he was 5 months old. He died in his sleep.
Mm.
This put quite the conundrum on Gwen and the church, because they taught that all blessings come from the Lord, and if anything bad happens, it's because the Lord was judging the congregation.
Ooh, well.
The leaders conducted an investigation into the families that they believed were struggling to find out which family it was that caused the Lord to be so displeased enough that they would take a shambling grandchild.
This is fucking gross.
Truly, and this is in the 2000s.
This is recent.
Yeah. Just a side note about Michael. You can actually watch his music videos on YouTube, and I beg you, please do it. Oh. He's actually not bad, but sometimes he decides to rap.
Oh, no.
Is
he really good?
When he's just singing, he's pretty good.
Okay.
The rapping is terrible. He's a white man.
Okay.
But he went through a lot, and I didn't want to get too much into David, but basically he didn't really want to be a part of the church. He was incredibly depressed.
Well, yeah, he can't eat.
Right. At some point in his adulthood, he starts to revolt against the church and admits to having affairs, and most of his songs are actually about fighting against the church.
Ooh, okay, I'm into that.
Yeah. Another wackadoo aspect of the Remnant Fellowship is that any marriages that take place have to be between two members of the church, and Gwen has to officiate all weddings.
What?
Yeah.
Why? I feel like she'd be a busy bee.
Ego. I don't know.
Okay. Ego.
Of course, from the very beginning of Remnant, Gwen expelled the idea of divorce and taught that marriage is forever. Well, that's until she wanted a divorce.
Oh, did the tides change?
The tides changed. In 2018, Gwen divorced her husband of 40 years.
God.
Sources say that this was not an amicable split and that David desperately wanted to remain married to his wife. However, Gwen had found a shiny, new, handsome poster boy named Joe Lara, who she married before the divorce papers were even put away.
Huh?
Yeah.
You can't. That's illegal. You can't do that.
I mean, it was like, divorce married.
The ink had not yet dried.
No. Joe Lara is an actor who is best known for his role as Tarzan in a made-for-TV movie. He was very pretty good looking back in the day and totally fit her idea of a perfect husband. He was always around to support her and her business. I mean, religion. Joe and a daughter from a previous relationship. And just to show you, like, what kind of a swell guy Joe is, in order to keep his daughter away from his ex, who wanted to move to Chicago and take the daughter with her, he called the police and told them that she had sexually abused their 4-year-old daughter. Yep. Totally a lie. Quickly, the police found out that he was lying.
Oh, okay. Go. Thank God.
But.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Garbage.
Joe was a stage man and loved the spotlight. He also loved money and was raised in a wealthy family, although by the time that he was in his 20s, he didn't have any money left. So he just bounced around from, like, well-off woman to well-off woman until he found Gwen.
Oh, a little sugar baby.
Yes. Gwen had a shit ton of money, and he was like, yeah, this'll do. I'm not religious, but I'm an actor. I'll figure it out.
Oh my God.
Yeah, all of his friends that were interviewed on the documentary was like, Joe was never religious. This is
so weird.
Most of the ones that they interviewed in the documentary went to acting classes with him.
Oh.
And they were like, I can see when Joe's acting. I know what that looks like. This is Joe acting. It's fascinating.
Gross.
After Gwen and Joe get married, and there are pictures, and there is an amazing video on YouTube about the whole hullabaloo. I want you to know that this woman's wedding dress is the princess gown of all princess gowns. Like, tulle for miles. She's teeny tiny, so she's got, like, this cinched up bodice. Like, yeah. Teeny tiny little cinched up bodice. And it looks like Cinderella's dress times 3.
Oh my God.
It's so interesting.
Is it a Panina Tournée?
Probably. The parishioners started realizing that services were getting shorter and Gwen wasn't around quite as much. Joe and Gwen were always off vacationing together somewhere, and their lifestyle seemingly started to morph into caring more about material things. They had a giant house, several expensive cars, designer clothes, etc.
Sure, sure.
The goal is for Remnant Fellowship to be self-sufficient. Eventually, they created a business arm of the church where there was a realty company, a car repair business, a plumbing business, and more.
Diversifying the portfolio.
Mm-hmm. So now people don't really need to do a whole lot outside of the church. You can get everything you need.
Oh, she made a monopoly.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm sorry. That's like a terrible, mm-hmm. but very savvy business.
Yeah. And all of her parishioners worked in these businesses. So if you wanted to leave the church,
you got
to
leave your job.
You got to leave your job.
Oh my.
So it's just weaving all of these things in together. So it's hard to leave. Well, and you're going to raise all your children.
And I'm sure they're paying tithe to the church. So they go, you pay them, and then they just come and they give your money right back to you.
Yeah.
It's like Victoria's Secret when we worked there.
Yes. We paid tithes to Victoria's Secret.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we just turned around and handed them our paycheck.
That's true. There was actually, when they would do all these conventions and stuff like that, the rhetoric originally was like bringing gifts for the Lord and gifts for the church and blah, blah, blah. And people would like bring baskets and be like, here's cookies I made. Here's
cute
a candle, like things like that.
Yeah.
And in the, I think it was the mid-2000s, they started holding bigger conferences, and they finally just said, actually, you know what? No more gifts. Just bring money. That's what we need. We need money.
Ew. No Christmas gifts, please. Just gift cards.
Right. So, yeah. Basically, all of the people who go to the church all their lives are entwined into all these other businesses. HBO Max was about two-thirds of the way done filming their docuseries called The Way Down when something shocking happened. Ooh. On May 29th, 2021, Gwen, her husband Joe, Gwen's son-in-law Brandon, another two couples of the Remnant Church boarded a small private Cessna plane to go to Palm Beach. Shortly after takeoff, the plane crashed into Percy Priest Lake.
I heard about that. The plane crash, that wasn't too long ago.
May 29th.
Oh, yeah. That was on Labor Day. Is that in Tennessee? No, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Ian. Okay, so Ian's birthday is May 27th. I took him to Nashville.
Oh, shit.
For his, we were in Tennessee when that happened. I remember that was playing on a TV while we, like, had brunch or something.
That was Gwen and her whole family.
No way.
Yes.
That's crazy.
That is crazy. So, all of the people above aboard the plane died.
Ooh. Well. At least you know it wasn't because the plane was overweight.
True.
I'm sorry.
True. You're not lying.
I know.
It believed that Joe was actually flying the plane, and later that day, it was announced that all the passengers had perished in the crash. According to an article on Esquire by Lauren Crank, although both Joe, Laura, and Brandon Hannah had pilot's licenses, Laura's medical certification had expired, and Hannah was not certified for the aircraft that they were flying. So nobody was flying this plane that, like, knew what they were doing. Oh. Or, I mean, maybe he did, but, like, they didn't have the certification or whatever.
Oh, no.
Elizabeth Shamlin filled the void her mother left and is still currently running Remnant Fellowship in the Way Down program today.
Oh.
Currently, Remnant Fellowship churches are now found in over 170 state cities worldwide.
Yikes.
They deny all the allegations against them, and their response to HBO's documentary on their website says, Remnant Fellowship categorically denies the absurd, defamatory statements and accusations made in this documentary, yet another Hollywood attack on religion. Ugh. And that is Gwen Shamblin, Laura, and the Way Down program.
That's disgusting. I hate every single square inch of that.
Do you want to see a picture of her?
I do.
Hold on.
Do you have a picture of the wedding dress?
Yeah. I do. All right, so this is Gwen and Joe.
Wow. Quite a haircut on that one.
It just keeps getting bigger.
She looks like she looks like a caricature of Teresa Caputo.
Who?
Teresa Caputo, the Long Island medium.
Oh, yeah, she does. Yeah.
Just yellow blonde hair all the way to heaven.
Yep. All the way to heaven.
That's where she's hiding her calories.
Absolutely.
Oh, what a look. Go look on Instagram.
It's wild. Let me find her wedding dress.
We're going to have a lot of stuff in the Instagram.
I had to make two for our true crime.
I saw that. We just have too much information.
Too many pics.
What a visual podcast.
Right.
We are.
That's us. the visual podcast.
Yeah. Hey, do you you know Beverly Hills's zip code?
90210?
Yeah. Did you know do you know Dawson's Creek zip code?
No.
It's 90108. 90108 for my life.
You ding dong. So
what?
The video is so good.
Wow.
They even made an engagement video.
Is it so cringe?
It's horrible.
But are they on YouTube?
I think so. I'll have you watch it.
Okay.
But that's my cult today.
That is a great job that you did telling of such a terrible story.
So gross.
I do like the little bit of poetic justice at the end, though.
Oh, man. I mean, I hope if there is a Lord, I hope that he made her sit down and wait outside those pearly gates for a goddamn minute.
We need to have a meeting.
And think about what she has done. Because it was not okay.
I hope he made her eat so much cake she got sick.
Yeah, that would be good.
Mm-hmm.
Of like, I want it to be Matilda when the little kid has to eat all the cake.
Oh, I haven't seen Matilda.
Oh, that's a good one.
I'm sorry. You know, here's what I really hope. I hope that just from my life experience, I know that she has to be like in a tremendous amount of pain.
Yeah.
And dealing with her own trauma to have that line of thinking. I can't imagine like how that plagued her entire life, but also fuck her for all the damage that she caused.
Yeah. Yeah. Real rough.
Real rough. I hope she's able to eat as many Snickers as she wants now.
Me too. So, what's your bright and shiny today?
My bright and shiny is that as soon as we're done recording this episode, I'm going home and Ian and I are leaving.
You're off.
We're off. We're out of here. And I'm so excited to see the Grand Canyon.
That's so fun.
I know. You know what? I packed. I was entirely packed, ready to go yesterday.
Yeah.
This is another thing that threw off my timetable.
Uh-huh.
And then, because I looked like 4 days ago and it's Arizona. I'm like, the weather was like, it's going to be 90 to 95 sure. every single day.
No.
Okay. Well, I looked today.
Uh-oh.
It is going to be colder in Arizona than it is here in Indiana.
Oh.
I might actually see snow.
Shut up.
I swear it's gonna rain all 2-3 days that we're gonna be there.
Okay.
We're gonna go up in the mountain to the south rim of the Grand and it's gonna rain and be cold. Like the low is like 31 degrees.
Holy shit.
I know. The high is 50 in Sedona the day we're going to Sedona. It's just so I had to unpack and get a whole new game plan.
New wardrobe.
Yeah.
Oh, that would throw off my team title too.
Yeah.
I don't blame you for that.
No. I'm like, I'm just glad that I looked because all I had were biker shorts and tank tops. So.
Welp.
Welp.
Real glad that we reevaluated.
Same.
Yeah.
What's your bright and shiny?
I'm really excited for this party tonight. This 90s party. I think it's just going to be a great time.
You better post a picture of your outfit because it's super cute.
I hope it turns out as cute as I think it is. We'll see. I have to curl my hair in like tiny, tiny curls.
I love a little ringlet moment.
Yeah, I'm going to have to like get started on that like as soon as we're done.
Mm-hmm. You better do the bangs.
Yeah, yeah.
Although in true 90s fashion, you would flat iron your bangs straight to your face.
That's true.
And then pin curl the rest of your hair.
Yeah.
If you want to be authentic to the times. Okay. Do you have a crimper?
I don't.
Oh, bummer.
No, I have. I don't know if I'm going as or if I'm inspired by Ty from Clueless.
Yeah.
So her hair in the outfit I'm going in is like all up in a scrunchie. I have to show you the scrunchie I bought. That might be my bright and shiny is the scrunchie. It's fucking huge.
Is it?
It is the biggest scrunchie I've ever seen in my life. I'm so excited. I cannot wait.
Oh, I love it.
It's
show me.
Like corduroy.
No!
It's so cute. I can't wait. I will wear it daily. I promise.
I just bought a corduroy skirt.
Yes.
It is orange, very pumpkin-y. Oh. I'm wearing it to DeadCon, so come see us at DeadCon
yes.
if you want to see my corduroy skirt. I've never worn anything like it in my life.
Oh my god, you're going to look so freaking cute.
I can't wait. Speaking of what...
DeadCon is over by the time this comes out.
Oh, never mind. Well, I
hope you liked it.
Hope you all enjoyed my orange corduroy skirt. I had a great time wearing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else? Anything?
I think A mashup comes out on the 31st, so that's like Sunday.
Bonus episode, yep, Sunday.
So, and then make sure you're following us on Instagram. We are giving away a basket on Halloween at 8 p.m. I will draw a name. So
keep an eye out for that.
Following us on Instagram, and then there's some instructions. I have like a little thing that you have to do. Yeah. So,
go look for the post.
Go look for that.
And be kind to yourself
and to others.
Goodbye.